Welcome to WISO Weekend, the home of WISO produced news and features. I'm Jerry Kenny. Later in today's program, we've got Dayton Youth Radio and WISO's occasional art series, Culture Couch. Up first, let's talk a little politics. The two major party candidates, Trump and Clinton, have dominated the daily news cycle since receiving their party's nominations in July. This week, we spoke with Dan Zink, Montgomery County Development Director for the Ohio Libertarian Party, about their presidential hopeful, Gary Johnson. Dan, thanks for speaking with us. So let's talk a little bit about the Libertarian platform here in Ohio.
Well, Libertarian platform, we're always pushing for smaller government and more freedom. Essentially, if you boil it down to the smallest point, you can do what you want as long as you don't harm others. And that's essentially what Johnson is pushing as well.
The Libertarian Party so far hasn't gotten a lot of press. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
It's the way the society is. It's a two-party system is the way it has been for hundreds of years. And that's just how it is. People just seem to think that the only chance to win is a Republican or Democrat, but we're trying to show the opposite.
And so let's talk a little bit about Gary Johnson's qualifications. What appeals to you about him?
Gary is a successful two-term governor from New Mexico, which is traditionally a Democrat state, and he was elected as a Republican at the time in the early 2000s. And he didn't win his first election by that much, but he won his second one about 60%.
He hasn't been allowed to participate in any of the debates. The third one just wrapped up Wednesday night. How do you feel about how he's been treated by the debate commission and the larger media?
Well, the debate commission is a whole story. It was founded by the Republicans and Democrats and is run by the Republicans and Democrats. And the 1 year that they did allow third party in, Perot in 92, they had their rules a lot less stringent. And since he messed up their narrative, they raised the percentage requirement to 15%, and it's been that way since. It used to be no percentage requirement, just to be on enough ballots to win, which 270, and Gary's on the ballot in all 50.
I don't think a lot of people know about that.
They don't really publish it, and the name itself lends to be an official body, but it is run by the parties in control.
How do you feel about Johnson's performance as a national presidential candidate? He's had a couple of missteps in some interviews naming national leaders, but again, he's been largely unheard of.
Yes, that is one of the biggest issues we have. People just don't know who he is. It's really hard to get your name out when society is so focused on Republicans and Democrats, and the fact that the Libertarian Party has maybe 10 cents for every $10 that the Democrats and Republicans have to actually advertise.
What's taking place locally to help get Johnson's message out?
We have door-knocking campaigns. We have phone banks for the whole state. There's county contacts for the campaign and regional contacts. The Gary Johnson campaign is set up very well, especially since we've gotten a lot more donations this time around since the universal dislike of Trump and Clinton.
Speaking of those candidates, are libertarians holding fast for Johnson and regardless? And are you worried about splitting either the Republican vote or Democratic vote helping either one of those candidates?
Interestingly enough, the libertarians seem to pull equally from both sides, especially with Sanders supporters being pushed out by the Democrat Party when they were conspired against. I saw a poll that said around 50% of Sanders supporters are actually going for Johnson. And Johnson does appeal well with his message of fiscal responsibility and social acceptance to more the middle-of-the-road Republicans and those that are the never-Trumpers. In Ohio, I mean, Johnson's pulling around 9 to 10%, and that's extremely high for a battleground state.
You think that has to do with the popularity or unpopularity of the two major party candidates?
Yes. I've seen multiple polls saying that Clinton's favorability is 45% and Trump's even lower. But those people that decided finally not to put up with it anymore, that they can't stand those two choices, are looking for an alternative. And we're ramping up operations. We're going door-to-door more the closer we get to election, delivering pamphlets. Libertarian Party, I mean, like every party, has a big boost in activity around presidential election time. So we've got our regional director set up, and Montgomery County is working on getting official recognized party status. We're just a county development group. So we need to find enough people that are active and get them elected to positions such as treasurer, chair, vice chair, central committee, and executive committee.
Dan Zink is the county development coordinator in Montgomery County for the Libertarian Party. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yes, thank you.
William Shakespeare famously said, "All the world's a stage," and Jonathan Crocker has taken those words to heart. For the past 26 seasons, this Yellow Springs native has been performing in front of thousands of people from a pit of mud. Jonathan is the founder of the Theater in the Ground troupe. Their original adaptation of Beowulf has been performed well over 2,000 times at Renaissance festivals across the country. Community Voices producer Renee Wild digs into the story.
I'm joining the throngs of people navigating between rows of cars in a crowded parking lot. They're making their way towards the entrance of the Ohio Renaissance Festival. This event, which runs from Labor Day weekend through October, is now in its 26th year. But this is my first time going. The gates open and the crowd surges forward into the 30-acre park that recreates life in 16th century England. It's a little overwhelming at first. There is so much to look at, including the crowd, who are dressed in every imaginable interpretation of classic 16th century fashion, including a large contingent of fairies and elves. But I don't have time to gawk, because I'm on a mission.
Can you point me towards the Mudditorium?
If you travel down this path to the left, you'll see the Mudditorium. There are muddy things there.
I'm looking for the mud show.
Hi, ma'am. Well, you've made it to the condiment bar. You're not quite there yet.
I'm looking for the mud show. Did I find it?
You are awfully close.
When I find Jonathan Crocker, he is trudging barefoot in a pool of mud.
Are you Jonathan?
Well, welcome to my world here. I'm mucking the mud this morning. Weather like this, good mud doesn't just happen.
It's a little chilly this morning, I must say.
Jonathan is one of three actors who performs four shows a day here from a 12-foot pit of mud.
We are called Theater in the Ground. That's our company name. But it's pretty much everybody refers to us as the Mud Show. And it has become one of the centerpieces of the festival.
Mud Show!
I have a degree in history, and when I was between my last 2 years of college, I heard about this thing called the Renaissance Festival in upstate New York. I was very intrigued with the blending of history and theater, and so I auditioned and got a role. I was cast as the village idiot. And it was much more than an acting job, actually, because I was on the street cast, and that meant that I was interacting with people all day long, improvising all day long. And there were a couple of guys who were beggars, and they were doing a show involving mud. It was very intriguing because I saw the power that the mud had to galvanize an audience. And I had just read Beowulf, and I thought, the pit of evil, the pit of mud, there's a great connection there, and it's a perfect piece to put in a Renaissance festival. It became a hit. Actually, that very same season, we were picked up by another Renaissance festival, and then the following season picked up by another Renaissance festival, and before I knew it, just out of college, I had this gig on the road performing at festivals as far away as Texas. You know, I figured I'd give it a shot for a couple of years and see how it went, and that was 32 years ago.
Yeah! 1, 2, 3, 4,
It's definitely a happening once we get rolling. Everybody is very much involved. Theater at first was a way of sort of separating people from action so they could feel comfortable, you know, watching and looking and being involved in other people's lives, which was sort of taboo. These days, we have all the isolation we need. What we really are hungry for is interaction and places where we can feel comfortable with other people and making spontaneous connections. And so this festival environment really fosters that. It's our tool. Once my foot goes in that mud, there is a visceral, vicarious response to that.
It's almost like the mud is another actor.
Oh, absolutely. We refer to it as a character in the show. It definitely plays a very big part. It's makeup, it's costuming. It's, in Beowulf, I transform from a good little boy into a monster. And once I've got mud all over me, I am truly frightening to people.
By the end of the show, Jonathan is covered head to toe in thick brown mud. A wide smile stretches across his face as he places a muddy arm around a young woman and strikes a pose for the camera. It's easy to see that this is an actor in his element.
You know, I have been here since day one. There's a level of participation in the show for people that you don't really get. You certainly don't get in a movie, and you don't get in most staged performances either.
For WYSO, I'm Community Voices producer Renee Weil.
Alas, this will be the last day for the 2016 Renaissance Festival. They're open now until 6 p.m. You can find more information on our website at wyso.org. The Dayton Ballet is getting ready to put on a show about a man who's ageless. And the challenge is how the ballet will bring this centuries-old story to longtime fans and entice new ones. Culture Couch's Lauren Schaus has been backstage.
The ballet is about the world's most famous vampire, Dracula. The Dayton Ballet is readying their new production, Dracula Bloodlines.
Yeah, they're not going to, she's not going to get into that.
Well, she doesn't have to.
In the Dayton Ballet's production space, two costumes hang side by side. The first is a furred garment, embellished with gold coins and ornaments, designed for a 15th century prince and warrior. The second is a long, sleek black cloak, lined in blood red, meant for a man who's walked the earth for centuries and seen all of its evils. These are the two sides of Dracula that the ballet presents, the mortal man and the immortal nightmare.
We wanted to do something fresh for the Halloween season. You can't do Dracula in February or...
This is Ray Zupp, the production and costume designer for Dracula Bloodlines. He says that what previous versions of Dracula have often lacked is understanding for its main character.
We look at him as kind of a sympathetic character in a way. What would drive you to lead that kind of life? And, you know, the thing we kept coming back to was love.
In this case, the love of a woman, a love that Dracula loses. The Dayton Ballet's artistic director and Dracula's choreographer, Karen Russo Burke, figured that the best way to stir up sympathy for this villain was to tell his origin story.
The concept of having a kind of a prequel was my concept, and I worked with my son on it, my older son, who knows a lot about folklore and mythos. But I also knew that people, you know, really would be looking for the Bram Stoker version as well.
Bram Stoker introduced Dracula to the world in his 1897 Gothic novel. The ballet moves from far in the past into the present day and includes some of Stoker's familiar characters and some new ones, like Lilith. Based on a figure from Jewish folklore, she's cast here as the mother of vampires, as old as time itself.
Everything she's wearing looks like it's made out of creatures. I mean, she's got a rib cage that is exposed, and it's on top of her, this leather reptilian corset, and she looks like she's just been around for a very long time. She's a creature of the woods.
Creating a brand new ballet from the ground up obviously takes time, and this one was created quickly.
Even the Royal Ballet takes about, you know, a year, year and a half, 2 years to develop something like this. And we're doing it in under a year, which is crazy and awesome and fun and terrifying.
The Dayton Ballet is hoping that this fresh content will also help draw fresh blood, as it were, into the audience. In general, says Karen, ballet audiences tend to be older.
I think some young people have a preconceived notion of what ballet is.
Many think ballet is boring, old-fashioned, Dracula has challenged these notions in its promotional materials, which are dark and sensual, with Ray's avant-garde costumes at center stage.
Karen, another reason why she brought me on is because I'm younger. You know, I have a younger sense of design. Definitely not classical. There's very few things in this ballet you'll see costume-wise that looks classical.
The Dayton Ballet has also paired up with Miami Valley arts education organization Muse Machine to introduce a new generation to ballet.
We're bringing in a lot of students that opening night, and they're about high school age, about 14 and 15 and above. And I think if we can get kids that age to see a live performance, it may open up a lot of what they think is out there.
Karen says the ballet has worked hard to draw the audience into Dracula. Three opera singers will act as a kind of chorus, telling the story. As the dancers perform, the opera singers will communicate the thoughts and desires of the characters to the audience by singing in English.
If you feel as though you're not going to understand it because it's ballet, you have three art forms telling this story, and taking it all in will not be a problem. I think you'll understand it. I think you will sympathize with some of the characters and be moved by the end of the evening.
The music featured in this story comes from the ballet's second act and was composed by Austin Jockwith, who also composed the ballet's libretto. Dracula Bloodlines runs October 20th through the 23rd at the Victoria Theater. For WYSO's Culture Couch, I'm Lauren Chows.
You can see production photos from the ballet at our website, wyso.org. Dayton's premier car show is the annual Concours d'Elegance, where every vehicle has earned an invitation to be on display. Last month, more than 6,000 people strolled the field at Dayton's Carillon Historical Park, which held over 200 restored and antique cars. Community Voices producer Jim Kale was one of them, and he found a display of miniatures vying for their own award.
As I entered the manicured lawn of the park, I was treated to automotive eye candy in every direction. Bentley, Bugatti, Pierce Arrow, even a 1918 Willys Overland were on display. At the far end of the field is the Transportation Building, and on this day, home to a show within a show. Organizer and participant Randy Westfield stood by his display.
What we had really hoped in doing all this is to take people's thinking from, oh, we're little boys playing with cars, to the point where they realize this is art. And these guys are doggone serious about art.
The accuracy and attention to detail of the model cars and motorcycles is astonishing. I was particularly taken with a 1/24th scale model of a vintage motorcycle. The detailing was flawless, down to realistic chips in the paint and dirt in the tire treads. It would be hard to distinguish from its full-size counterpart in a photograph. I talked with longtime model maker Randy Durr about what it takes to craft these small models.
We are talking about scale replicas of automobiles. Replicas can be an exact duplicate of a particular vehicle, or they may just be from the mind of the builder. Some of the models will be kit builds. The builder will have detailed them, painted them to make them look more realistic. You will also see vehicles that may be 100% scratch built. Pieces and parts did not exist until the builder created them from raw materials.
This sounds like it takes a tremendous amount of time.
Many models built from kits can take as little as 20, 30 hours. I've been known to spend 2,500 hours on a scratch building project spanning over 5 years' time.
What does it take to set up a workshop to be able to build high-quality models?
Not very much, really. You need a dedicated spot. A card table is more than adequate. You need a small arsenal of tools, hobby knife, paintbrushes, tweezers, sanding papers, things like that. Probably the biggest resource you're going to need is patience, committing the time to the project, and being willing to recognize when something you've done is not up to the standard you expect, that you're okay with stepping back and redoing that so that it does meet the standard you want.
The builder of the motorcycle model that so captivated my attention is Evan Jones. He is a prolific builder, finishing around 12 projects a year. He drove the 6.5 hours from his home in Canada to participate. Is your display area going to overtake the size of your workshop?
Yes, it will pretty soon, yes. And like most modelers, we have more models than we're going to probably live to build. We call it SABLE. It's stash accumulated beyond life expectancy.
In your house or garage, there are stacks and stacks of kits waiting to be built?
Yes, about 150 kits that I want to build.
Every builder has personal reasons for choosing their subjects. Sometimes it is nostalgia or to pay tribute to a great car or design. Occasionally it is to express a personal vision or to take up a difficult challenge. The Concours d'Elegance certainly provided this enthusiast the opportunity to see very rare cars well presented on the show field, both full-size and in miniature. Perhaps the models and the passion shared by their builders will inspire some of us to build our own dreams in scale. This is Jim Kale for WYSO Radio.
You can hear more Culture Couch stories on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. On this week's Dayton Youth Radio, we'll hear a story from Naja Long, a student at the Dayton Early College Academy, about the memory of her grandmother. Here's Dayton Youth Radio Project Director Basim Blunt.
I've learned so much in working with the teenagers from Dayton Youth Radio. One of the things I realized is that many teenagers' first experience with death is through the loss of their grandparents. It's the first time they have to go to a funeral home or see a deceased loved one in a hospital. Today we have a remembrance from DECA student Najay Long. It's called Macaroni and Cheese.
My name is Najay Long. I am a sophomore at DECA. My story is about a person that was very special to me. She was short, light-skinned, and could pour her heart out into macaroni and cheese. I watched as she added all the ingredients to the pot, and we felt the steam hit our face. I am an only child, so I did not have to share the time I spent with my granny with anyone. Growing up, my clothes never matched. My mom always had something negative to say about how I dressed myself. My granny's input was to keep being yourself and continue to do what makes you happy. To find out more about my granny, I spoke with my mom, Nicole, who was my granny's oldest child. She wasn't my granny's favorite, but runner-up.
I am here with my mom, Nicole Williams. So, how's your day going?
It's going fine.
So, what are you doing right now?
I am working my first job.
I see you on your cellular device. What are you doing on there?
You're taking a picture of this interview. Because you surprised me.
Okay, time for the serious questions. So, how did you feel when Granny died?
I was sad, but I was expected.
If she was standing right here right now, what would you ask her?
I wouldn't ask her anything. I would just tell her I love her. And I'm glad to see her. Let's go to lunch.
What's one of your favorite memory about Granny?
She called me every morning to tell me she loved me.
Do you remember why she got cremated?
Because she said she didn't want to wake up in the ground with bugs in her face. I told her that wouldn't happen, but it was also cheaper to cremate.
My granny also spoiled me with love and attention when no one else could. In 2014, she was in and out of the hospital. When I found out she was gone, I was in school. It was my freshman year, the last day before winter break. Once I got done taking my language arts final, I was on my phone, on Instagram, and I got a text from my childhood friend saying she was sorry. When I responded, I asked her what she was talking about. She finally told me that my granny passed away at 2 o'clock in the morning, December 19, 2014. Once my mom picked me up from school, I asked why she didn't tell me my granny passed. Her response was, "I wanted you to focus on your finals. I was going to tell you once you got home." Once I did get home, I cried my eyes out. I did my story about her because she was an important factor in my life. I know death is not a happy situation. Death is something you can't get through alone. A death is something that you need comfort with, like food or like attention and love from like your family. So you have to face reality and keep pushing through your life. For Dayton Youth Radio,
This is Najee Long.
That was a feature entitled Macaroni and Cheese, written and produced by Najee Long from the Dayton Early College Academy. Special thanks to Ann Rasmussen at DECA. Dayton Youth Radio is available as a podcast on iTunes and is also available on the WYSO website. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
Hear more stories from our Dayton Youth Radio project at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the final week of middle fall, the last week of the frog and toad migration moon. I went out into the woods and fields this morning. Small cups of gossamer were shining with dew, hanging to the tips of the dry wing stem. In the mist, the grass was yellowing and the woods appeared like it does in April, bright leaves like new flowers. Seeds were sprouting in rotten tree stumps, and the sweet smell of autumn soil was all around me. The low sun rested in the treetops. The silver, winding river, the fallen logs, invisible in summer, lay below me. I saw a small flock of robins at the riverbank, and then further upstream, the trees were full of robins. Fat green osage fruits lay all over the ground. In one dark patch of ironweed stalks, a few blue tall bellflowers were blooming. Off to the side, parsnips were flowering, and some red clover and small white asters. In the bottomland, poison hemlock was growing back with the chickweed and the sedum. Peppergrass plant was blossoming as though spring were going to arrive in a few weeks. In one corner of the pasture, wild lettuce plants, leaves shriveled, displayed dozens of prominent white seed heads, each maybe an inch and a half in diameter. When I touched the heads, they dissolved between my fingers. Blackbirds and starlings passed over the woods heading southwest. One monarch butterfly came by early in the afternoon, sailed over my head, the sun shining through its wings. A few loud, slow katydids sang tonight, maybe their last songs of the year. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late fall. In the meantime, listen for the last katydids of the year.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Join us then. Up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.
Hi, this is Cindy Funk, host of The Dear Green Place, now on Sundays at 1 p.m. Have a little Celtic chill on Sundays, kicking back and relaxing with some great Celtic songs and tunes. Every radio will be a Dear Green radio. Sundays, 1 p.m., The Dear Green Place on WYSO.
Up with the news these days can be like drinking water out of a fire hose. It's all coming at you all day long, online, over the air, even stuff you hear on the street. I'm Michelle Martin, weekend host of All Things Considered. We're here to help you figure it out, what matters most and how it will affect you. Join us every Saturday and Sunday for All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 5 on your public radio station, 91.3 WYSO.